All right. Thank you, Mary. And so I've been like overhearing, and there's some skepticism about my talk, and why would the fields be interested in having me? So yes, I was in a math department. I was a professor. Really, you can look that up. And I was a physicist at one point. So I figured physics, math. And now I am a biologist at NIH, where we have this lab with former string theorists, myself, and some other mathematicians that are now doing work on diabetes, metabolism, obesity, and neuroscience. And so when I showed up at NIH in 2004, I was indeed a math professor. I came to NIH. And this was the graph that they showed me, which was that up to about 1970, the average weight in the United States was roughly constant. It's around here. And starting in the mid-70s, it started to increase linearly. So till now, we've increased about 10 kilograms in net weight from the 70s to now. So that's not necessarily the obesity epidemic. It could just be everybody was weightlifting and got bigger. But but there's more. So now here's the distribution in 1970, right? So this is BMI. BMI is the measure of how much body fat you have. I know it's an imperfect measure. The first time anyone, especially physicists, think about BMI, they think this can't be a correct measure. Arnold Schwarzenegger is considered obese because his BMI is 35. This is true. But surprisingly, Arnold Schwarzenegger is an outlier. For most people are not that buff. And indeed, BMI is a pretty good, accurate measure of body fat. If you try to regress any kind of function of weight and height versus body fat, you end up with BMI. It's actually a mystery of why it works. So I actually have a pocket theory I won't talk about. But so in 1971-74, obesity is considered BMI greater than 30. Okay, so this part of the population is obese. This part is 25 is overweight, and this is not. So you see that it's completely arbitrary, right? I could have said obesity was 40, then it would be very small. I could have said obesity is 25, and then it would have been huge. Now, here is 76. Okay, not much. Probably statistical noise. I doubt a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test would tell the difference between these two. 88-94, here we go. This is where people started to notice, okay? And the reason why the obesity epidemic is so dramatic is that they stuck the line exactly at the steepest part of this slope. So any small movement will indeed cause a giant increase. But, you know, the area under here is getting bigger. And here is 2005 to 2006. So the number of obese has doubled or even more than doubled. If you use 30 as a cutoff, you choose some other cutoff, you'll get a different number. But still, there is a question of why is there more, why is this thing moving, right? I think the more interesting question is why are there people that are immune to the obesity? Why is this not just a cult translation? Why is this an expansion? So there's two questions to this. So if you want to think about obesity, unfortunately, this thing didn't show up. The color didn't work. But this is like a tank of gas flowing in to a boiler. Okay, so this is the heater in your house. And this is actually, to zeroth order, the spherical cow model of the body. Because you get input coming in, and the interesting thing about you is, unlike a car where you have a gas tank, you are the gas tank. You are the fuel. So we have food intake, we eat, then we burn energy, and then the difference between the two is what we store. Right? So that's our body fat. So if you want to account for the obesity epidemic, we need to account for the difference between the intake and the expenditure, and that's the storage. Right? So if we can account for both of these things, we can understand what's causing it. Is it that expenditure is going down, or is it that intake is going up, right? That's the question we want to know. Most of the country, the food industry, everybody thinks its expenditure going down because it's a good thing to think. Politically, it's easy. But if it was intake going up, what do you do, right? Okay. So biology is about flux. It's stuff going in and stuff going out. So it's rates, right? Flux is a rate. So we really want to know if the rate of storage, right, the rate of change in your body mass is about energy balance. So this is the intake flux, the amount of energy coming in. This is the amount of energy you burn. The difference will be the increase in the energy stored. But when you get on the scale, you measure kilograms, right? So you need to convert kilogram to energy. Instantly, your physicist, you're thinking E equals mc squared. No, 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 no. Not E equals mc squared, okay? It's chemical energy. It's the energy in a gas, in gasoline when you burn it. It's that energy, okay? It's like the E equals mc squared. It's an infinitesimal amount, but it's still quite a bit. So we need a density, right? We need to convert mass to energy. And that's what this density is. So we have to figure out what this density is. So the problem with the density is that, you may or may not know this, is that we're not homogeneous, right? We're comprised of bone, mostly water. I remember this great Star Trek episode when it was like mostly bags of water or something they would call humans. Well, that's what we are. We're mostly bags of water, about 60%, 70%. And then, you know, we have minerals, bone, and water. These have no caloric content. And then we're comprised of fat, carbohydrates, and protein. Even though we mostly eat carbs, we have surprisingly small amount of carbohydrates, okay? We have carbohydrates stored as glycogen, which is in your liver and your muscle. It's only a few kilograms per person. That's why when you run a marathon and you hit the wall, hitting the wall is when you run out of that glycogen. And it just happens that in about 2 hours, you use up all your glycogen. So that's why the wall comes right about mile 20. And then you have protein. And so these have energy densities. Fat is about twice as energy dense as protein and carbs. And this is about the same as the energy density of gasoline. Okay, so fat and gas, if you think about it, they're about the same. So really we have this machine is we have multiple fuel sources. We have fat coming in, carbohydrates coming in, protein coming in, and then they're getting burned. All right, so now we have to understand, if we want to understand how are you changing in body weight with different intakes, you have to account for these different fluxes. So this is a macronutrient flux. Right? So really what you have is that energy density, you can divide it into a sum over energy densities of glycogen, protein, and fat. Right? So now we have one equation, three unknowns. So we need to make three equations, right? And then we have the inputs. You're eating fat, carbohydrates, and protein. So we need to make three equations, right? So here we got three equations. Now we need to divide the energy expenditure into three, right? So in particle physics, it would be called a mixing angle. You need a mixing angle because you need to decide how much of the energy is going to fat, how much is going to carbs, how much is going to protein. And so this is the fraction of fat utilized and the fraction of carbs utilized. And there's a conservation in stuff, so the fraction of protein utilized is just 1 minus the fraction of fat and the fraction of carbs, right? So that's, so far, we've gotten to this point. And then we want to reduce to a 2D model. For reasons of in dynamical systems, the difference between 2D and 3D is a Fields medal, okay? Because 2D can be completely explained. 3D is chaos. That's what made Poincaré famous, was studying 3D. So we want to reduce it to 2D because we don't want to deal with all these problems. And so how do we reduce it to 2D? Well, we notice that glycogen supply is small, right? So if we average it on a long time scale, then you can just set it to zero, right? So the amount of glycogen is zero. Now I can just solve for the fraction that's carbs, right? It's just equal to the amount you eat as carbs divided by your energy. And then I substitute that in to my equation. And now I rearrange. All right, now I have a 2D equation, right? Now I have an equation for fat and protein, but that doesn't give you how much you weigh, right? So what happens is as you add protein, you're adding water along with protein. And you also add some bone and minerals and things like that. So we want to account for the water that goes with the protein. So how do you do that? Well, you say that, well, let's say I just divide the body up into fat and everything else. And everything else I'll call lean. Okay, so this includes water, bones, minerals, vitamins, you name it. So then it turns out that you can quantify the change in protein to the change in water. It's pretty consistent, right? Because cells are so big, they're contained with water, there's extracellular fluid, that's kind of stereotypical. So as you increase in protein, you increase the water. So now I can convert the protein to lean, I can substitute that in, And then I realized that the amount you eat is protein and fat. That's just called the lean. And then that goes in. And now I have a two-dimensional equation. And so that is my body composition model, right? So I've gone, started with flux balance, and just with a little bit of thinking, you get to the body composition model, right? So now if I knew how much you ate, and if I knew how much you burned, and your mixing angle, I could then tell you what body percentage of fat you have, right? And these densities are known, so we know these densities. So I know the density of protein, I know the hydration coefficient, I just need F and E. And these are now functions of your body, okay? So depending on how big you are, you're gonna burn different amounts of energy, and the utilization fraction, F, the mixing angle, will also change depending on how big or small you are. So here's where dynamical systems comes in, okay? So now I have what's called a 2D autonomous differential system. So let's look at a simple dynamical system, right? So I used to teach freshman calculus, so this is what we did in freshman calculus. Or did we? I don't know. Maybe we didn't do it in freshman calculus. Maybe we only did the linear version. But here's something you should be teaching in freshman calculus because it's easier to teach than what we teach now. So we have this ordinary differential equation. It could be solved in terms of logarithms or the inverse. So first thing you do is you look for fixed points. Okay, fixed points are where nothing happens, so where dx dt equals zero. I always find fixed points the most fascinating part of a dynamical system, right? Because you got things going in, going out, and there's like some condition where nothing happens. To me, that's always been the miracle. And in fact, you can prove that in an autonomous system, it's a map mapping to itself, you got to have a fixed point, right? And that's a topological kind of argument. So the fixed points are when this is zero and when this is one. So that's equal to zero. And then we just represent this geometrically. Okay, so the whole point of dynamical system, this is what Poincaré invented, was that analysis, which is the study of how things in the limit of small or big change, is geometry. Or it's actually topology with geometry, because these are singularities in a vector field. So if I want to know how things are changing, I don't have to do any work. Say I wanted to know what happens if I just wait a long time given some initial condition. I know that if I'm between 0 and 1, well, between 0 and 1, this thing is a positive number. This is a positive number. So this is dx dt is positive. So if I'm between 0 and 1, I'm always going to increase. If I'm bigger than 1, this is a negative number. This is a positive number. I'm always going to decrease. So then I go here. And when I'm at the fixed point, it's 0, so I don't move. And if I'm negative, I run away. So I know no matter what initial condition I have, I know exactly where you're going, right? So I can tell you what you're going to be if I waited long enough. And that's dynamical systems in a nutshell, right? This is true if this is not time dependent. If it's time dependent, then you have to do different things. So we can do this in two dimensions. This is now a vector field, right? You can think of it as we're living in a plane of fat and lean, and you want to know what direction will fat and lean move, and you put a little arrow there. And so you have what are called null clines, is when fat doesn't move and when lean doesn't move. This is called the L null cline and the F null cline. You set them to zero, and now you have two equations and two unknowns for the E and the F. And if you just rotate coordinates, you get two conditions which make total physiological sense, is that when you are in energy balance, so when your weight is not changing and your body composition is not changing, then in fact what's happening is that you're burning exactly what you're eating, and the fraction of fat that you're burning is the fraction of fat you're eating. Okay. So that's what happens when you're in energy balance. So what this tells me is that if I knew what the null clines were, okay? So this is just some postulate. It could be anything, right? And I'll discuss what it could be. Then I know that at each point in space, there's a little arrow telling me where I'm going to go. So supposing my lifestyle sets up these things, okay? How much I eat and how much exercise I do, how big I am. It tells me where I want to be. And now I just so happen that an alien comes down and resets your body somewhere, right? Then you know that if you're here, you're not at equilibrium, you're going to move in this direction. And so no matter where you are, you'll move to the fixed point. So that tells me no matter, if you're eating something and your lifestyle is fixed, then you're going to be here. You're going to have this much fat and this much lean. That's what the equations are saying. And so the nice thing about 2D is that you can classify all the possible dynamics. Okay, this is it. There's also one more, which is going to infinity, but I'm assuming that that doesn't exist, that you don't go to infinity. So this is it. You can have, you know, a single fixed point. It's when these things cross once. You can have multiple fixed points, and you can have a countable number of multiple fixed points, right, in all sorts of weird things. You can have what's called a line attractor, or for the mathematicians, an invariant manifold, where the two null clines coincide. So now you have this whole marginally stable set of points. So you could be here, 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 and you could have a limit cycle. Okay, in 2D, that's it. That's all you can have. So the question is, if we knew the null clines, which is how your energy expenditure depends on your body composition, and we know how your fat fraction utilization, the mixing angle, depends on your body composition, then I could tell you what you're going to do. So at this point, we don't know which one of these they are, okay? Like Occam's razor tells me it's this one, maybe this, you know, probably not this or this. But, you know, who knows? So we need to do a little, now we need to get some data, right? So how do we measure energy expenditure, right? You're a human being, you're a biological thing, you're walking around. The interesting thing is that even though you're a pretty complicated entity, metabolically, you're just doing this. You're burning glucose, you're burning fat, this is palmitic acid, and you're burning protein, this is albumin. Okay? This also shows you what you need to live, right? To live, you need carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, and the one thing missing is phosphorus, which is the ATP. So you need those five elements to live. And I actually think the rate limiting step for life on Earth is the amount of phosphorus that we have. But, you know, we could debate the origin of life stuff forever. But, so, if I know the flux of the CO2 coming out and the amount of oxygen you consume, then we know that each of these reactions, we know how much energy is produced, right? I didn't write down energy, but each of these reactions, you're oxidizing this to make energy, right? That's the whole point. So this is making, you know, 17 or 16.8 kilojoules per gram or per mole or something per gram. And this is making, you know, twice as much, and this is making about 17. And so if I get the same amount of oxygen in and the same amount of carbon dioxide goes out, I know it's glucose, I know it has. So what I do is I measure the ratio of these two things and the absolute fluxes, and then I solve this this equation to get what I think the proportions of what you're eating are, and from that I estimate how much energy you're burning. Okay, so that's what people do. It's called indirect calorimetry. They actually have these sealed rooms where you can live in, or you can use an oxygen mask and walk around all day with that. But if you want to do 24 hours, you can live in this room where we measure exactly how much oxygen goes in and how much carbon dioxide is coming out, and from that I figure out, you know, what's going on, how much energy you use. Right, it's kind of like a detector at LHC. It's a calorimeter. It's just an indirect calorimeter. So we can also break up the energy expenditure rate into two pieces. All right. So there's the basal metabolic rate. So this is if you're just lying still and doing nothing, you're going to burn a certain amount of energy just to maintain osmotic pressure, to get ions pumping in and out. Your liver is actually using up probably most of the energy of the organs. Your brain's using maybe 20%. Your heart's using some energy. So just sitting around doing nothing, you're actually burning a lot of energy. You know, an average person might be between 1,300 and 1,600 calories a day. And then if you move around, you're going to burn some more energy. So we just have to account for both of these things. And so an average person maybe would burn 10 megajoules per day. I burn less. I actually have very low metabolism. I got measured once. I was like surprisingly low. People always said that I was a big pig and I ate a lot, but the truth is I don't. I just look like I eat a lot. That's about 115 watts. You've never seen me eat, so. It's just that I only eat like infrequently, but I eat large amounts. very spiky eating profile. So we're about 100 watts or so, right? So 100 watt light bulb, and your utility company would say it's 3 kilowatts per day. I always found this to be the most amusing measure, right? You take a watt, which is a rate, you multiply it by a time, and then you divide it by a time. Well, you know, whatever. So 3 kilowatts a day. So here's what I call the eco challenge, right? So each person in the house is burning, using up 3 kilowatts per day. So I think you should use less than the number of calories you eat, or the number of kilojoules you eat, right? So a family of four should try to use 12 kilowatts hours per day. That should be the target, right? Just for the hell of it. So now we want to know how much energy you are burning for different weights. Ideally, what you would do is you would take a person and say, okay, please be 60 kilograms now. Now be 72 kilograms. Now be 80 kilograms. Now be 30% fat. Now be 27% fat. Now be 40% fat. And we're going to measure your energy utilization. Right? So you would just take a person and you ask them to do this. Unfortunately, that can't be done. There's ethical and practical reasons. But I think the limitation is the practical reasons, really. But what we do is we make the same assumption we do in astrophysics, which is the homogeneity assumption, right? So the homogeneity assumption in astrophysics is this part of the universe looks like that part of the universe 13 billion years ago. There's a quasar. Oh yeah, it's got to be just like sort of like now, just far away and a long time ago. And so we can Doppler shift and say it's 13 million. Well, you know, things could be different, but no, we accept the homogeneous assumption in astrophysics. And so that's why we think that most of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. And so at the same time, we then do that in biology is we assume that cross-sectional data, so we assume that all people are the same, so that a big person is like a small person who would be like the small person if he got big, right? So that's the assumption. And so this is data from many people, and then you can fit a straight line through it, okay? You laugh, but this explaining 60% of the variance is much more than the variance that smoking explains for cancer or cholesterol explains for heart disease. And how many here take statins, especially my former professors? And that's based on less than this, okay? So if you're taking statins, then you can't laugh at this. So this is a regression line, and then you can just say, well, people have done this countless numbers of times. That's not true. They've done this a finite number of times, but lots of them. And then you can fit lines through these, and you can get the resting metabolic rate as a function of your lean and fat. Now, physical activity is also interesting because it seems to be just directly proportional to your mass, which makes sense, right? Because you're moving around 1/2 mv². So there's just some parameter multiplied by mass, and people have done this in multiple ways. They've measured energy expenditure for different sized people, and then they put backpacks on with weights and make them do exercises, and they see that it just linearly increases. And so energy expenditure due to physical activity is also a linear function of lean and fat. So E is linear in fat, and lean is a good approximation. Okay, if anything, it's maybe slightly sublinear. But humans are really, the reason why it's linear and the reason why biology has so many linear things is because the homogeneity assumption. We're essentially almost the same, so that even if it's some function, we're expanding, we're doing a Taylor series around a point, and it's just a teeny weeny point, and so we look linear, right? So there's nothing surprising about being linear. It's just that we're mostly the same. In fact, all mammals are the same. If you look at the phylogenetic tree of all life, right, there's archaea, there's bacteria, there's eukaryotes. We're just a little branch. It says animals. Okay, not even mammals, just animals. Right, there's a whole thing for like sponges and fungus. We're just animals. So you've seen that energy expenditure depends on fat, lean. It's a linear function. Then the single fixed point in mathematics is called generic because essentially you take some monotonic function, you're going to get a fixed point. Right? Now, if you wanted to do multi-stability, you have to do some fine-tuning. Okay, you have to have a fancier function. Okay, so this is where physicists and biologists disagree. And this is what I think the conflict between physicists and biologists are. Physicists think fine-tuning, they throw it out, right? That's how you throw out things. But in biology, you see, evolution is the process of exponentially amplifying exponentially unlikely events. So in biology, it's all about fine-tuning. Okay? There's a segment of the society that calls this intelligent design. And the reason is because it does seem designed, because it's exponentially unlikely. That's what evolution is all about. So you can't just throw out fine-tuning because it's, you know, you just can't throw that out. In this case, you can, but but that's a caveat that if you're interacting with a biologist, don't say, oh, that's fine-tuning, because then they'll go ballistic on you. Now, a line attractor also requires fine-tuning, and it's basically you're eating what you eat, and then there's a deviation as to how different you are from energy balance. So any homogeneous function of a difference from energy balance, this is just any function that's zero when I minus E is zero, then you add that onto this. Then you get a line attractor, and so the two attractors will coincide. Okay, so now we need to now know what this little F is to figure out energy expenditures. But there's a problem with little F, and that is you can't measure it in equilibrium, because in equilibrium is just how much fat you're eating, right? But that's not what you want to know. You want to know if you're out of equilibrium, what is the fraction of fat you're going to utilize? Because in equilibrium, you just get whatever you're eating, right? So that's so what we need to do is invert this dynamical equation. We need to know how you're changing your energy expenditure, and then we can infer F and what you're eating. Okay, so we need to extract F. So again, we have the longitudinal problem. Ideally, we would take a person, we'd just say, okay, I'd like you to start increasing weight and move around the phase plane, please, and then I'm going to measure your little F. I'm going to just leave you in this respiratory chamber for 30 years, and I'm just going to measure. And please don't age while you're in there, or, you know. And so you can't do that experiment. So again, we rely on the cross-sectional technique. And so here is what Gilbert Forbes, who was a pioneer physiologist, they're sad because physiology, it's like all the stuff I'm talking about was known prior to, say, 1960, and then it got forgotten. So the whole generation, and you know, I'm sort of rediscovering all these things. So if I gave this talk in 1960, everyone would be like, oh yeah, that's like old hat. If I gave it in 1990, they would like not walk out of the room. Now there's interest again. So there's this, we're coming back. Physiology is making a comeback. So here's the body composition. It actually formed, it's amazing that if you measure people with fat, it seems to lie on a curve. Okay, this is not expected. It could have just filled the plane. But it has this structure that you can get the lean body mass as a function of the fat. So what does that tell me? Well, now I can apply this to the model, right? Because I can just divide or multiply by dt or rho l, and I can just divide these two equations. And now I set this equal to f, solve this equation, and now I have, in real time, you have done the algebra, I can get fat fraction utilized. And then there's this little p thing. This is, I actually forget what it's called, the protein utilization factor or something like that. And this just this is like some function. Okay, so these have no adjustable parameters. These are all things. So there's no adjustable parameters. And now I can fit it to data. Okay, so does this actually work? So here's an experiment where they took people and they actually put them in a chamber, a sealed chamber. It's about the size of University College dorm room, single. And what they did is they said, okay, you're going to eat 1,600 calories. Well, now you're eating 700, buddy. fat goes down. So, you know, that's it. You're going to eat that, and we're going to measure you. And you sign the waiver, and that's it. You're in there for 12 days. And I'm not sure if this experiment was done pre or post internet access. So I don't know. They might have had a TV in there or something. And this is the fraction of the fat oxidized and the lean oxidized. And this is our model. Okay? And the difference, we deviate here because we didn't account for the glycogen. So we believe if we had a glycogen, we'd actually capture it. So remember, this model had no adjustable parameters. Right? So that usually it's a big hit among physicists, no adjustable parameters. And so we can match the data. And here's the amount of weight they lost. And this is the amount of fat they lost. And so you can see that they only did fat twice because you have to put them into a, you know, some scanner. You have to do underwater weighing. So you can't weigh the, you can't measure their body composition in the chamber, right? Soon they will be have this miracle chamber with an fMRI machine built around it. It'll be a 10 Tesla magnet. You'll live inside a 10 Tesla magnet. You know, just don't try to move too quickly. You might induce some currents in your head, but but that, you know, it's coming. For those clinicians in there, I know writing the IRB for that will be a challenge, but it's coming. So now we have the fat fraction utilized. We can now substitute it into our equation, and now we have the fat guys cancel out, and we can substitute into the lean as well. And we get this, what's called the energy partition model. And so now this is a model that has a line attractor as a fixed point. Okay? And you notice that what you eat no longer matters. It's just the total amount of calories. So it doesn't matter what you eat. So if you're on the Atkins diet, you're on the, you know, the whatever, the Pritikin diet, you're on the South Beach diet, doesn't matter. If you believe in this model, and interestingly, there's about 20 to 30 papers trying to model what I've just talked about. We reviewed it recently in a paper of ours. None of the papers cite any other paper, including authors don't even cite themselves. So they're like authors who wrote two papers, two different models. They didn't say, well, I had this other model, I didn't like it, I went and proved it. No, they just said, here's a new model. They didn't cite themselves. So there are all these papers. They're all different versions. Some are like computer algorithms, so they're not even differential equations. Some of them are, you know, just kind of hand-wavy things. And they all use energy partition. They all assume that. And this makes sense because, like, say you're eating a little bit more than you weigh, then some of it's going to go to lean and some of it's going to go to fat, right? So that's what kind of intuitively what you think. But none of them notice that if you believe that, you believe that the steady state is not its unique point. It's a line attractor. And so what does that mean? Well, this means that you, no different you, okay, just you, could be here. You could be entirely buff, lots of lean, low fat, Lance Armstrong. Or you could be over here, lots of fat, no lean. I don't want to name any examples. And then just depending on history alone, it would depend what your body composition is. So you could be here. You know, if you started here, you would go here. If you started here, you would go here. Now, the interesting thing is this is the constant weight line, right? Remember, like, weight is fat plus lean, so you could weigh a lot more. And even though you did nothing, you have the same lifestyle. You could be exercising the same amount. You could be eating the same amount. And now, if you change your lifestyle, that's just moving the null line, then, you know, depending if you're here or here, you're going to increase or decrease weight differently. And the other interesting is that if you are a line attractor or if you're a fixed point, every experiment we've done so far cannot tell the difference between the two. Because all experiments do so far is they manipulate exercise, kind of how much energy you burn and how much you eat. So they move. What they do is they move this set of null clines from here to here, or they move this line attractor from here to here, and so the trajectory would be the same. So the only way to really tell is you'd have to change your body mass, right? So right now my colleague is actually making measurements of the Biggest Loser show. I don't know if you know this, well, but there are these people that are slightly overweight, and then they, at the end of the thing, they can bench press 400 pounds and run a marathon. And so that's changing this. And now we can then, and then they always return. We know that. So we'll wait 5 years and see whether they come back to here or come back to here, and we may know. And so the problem is, here's a numerical example. So I can just re-express this thing, and I'm running out of time, so I have to quickly go. I won't even get to the punchline. Then if we do a numerical example of something with a line attractor and an invariant manifold, then if you do liposuction, for example, the fixed point would assume you would go back, whereas liposuction would, if you're an invariant manifold, you would just stay there. So the plastic surgery industry really wants this to be true, but, you know, we don't know. And the time constant is extremely long. See how long the time constant is? 3,000 days to get back. So, you know, a grad student can't do it. right? It takes 10 years to do this experiment, so you'd have to do first grad student would be, I started the experiment, that's his thesis. The second one was, I got in the middle of the experiment, I measured these guys, you know? The third one finally gets to publish in Nature. So, I mean, that's like the prop, no one's gonna do it. Okay, so here we're gonna try to apply it, the mean U.S. body weight. We're gonna try to explain this, right? So how do you do this? So what we thought was, okay, we have this model of how much you eat, how much do you weigh? So why don't we just apply it to the entire U.S. population, right? Because we know how much food is made, and we have a good estimate of how big people are. And so how do you do that? Well, you just simply, you make a one-dimensional equation again, you move E to the other side, you take the average over the entire U.S. population. So now if I know the average energy expenditure, the average change of lean and fat, then I know how much you ate. Okay, so we can do that. So we did this. And so this is how much the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization tells every country how much food is available per person. Okay, so this is, before you start jumping on me, this is accounted for pet food, wastage, eaten by rats, all that stuff. Okay, it's just, this is the amount that's available per person, and I really mean that. This is what the USDA thinks you waste. Okay, they just think there's some proportion is wasted. Okay, so you notice that this gap is the same as this gap. So this is how much the USDA actually thinks you eat based on surveys, looking in garbage cans, things like that. Okay, how much do you eat? And you just say, well, I had a steak last night and two potato chips and an apple pie. And they're like, okay, that's 682 calories and, you know, so forth. This is what the model says. Okay. So if I actually try to match the US population to the amount of, this is the amount of food we eat. So this is the amount we waste. It's about 1,400 calories. So we just published this, just came out last week, and it got a little bit of press coverage. So if you've read about it in the news, it was me, actually. And so what it's saying is that we started wasting around 900 calories, say in 75, and we're wasting about 1,400 calories per day now. And I think this explains the obesity epidemic, that there's a push effect. So what it is what happened was in 1970 in the Nixon administration, they changed agricultural policy and decided they're going to just subsidize soybean and corn, and we're just going to make as much as possible. And so they had to get rid of all this soybean and corn, and so food marketing became really good. And what I think, this is all speculation now, unfortunately I'm being recorded, so I could probably get fired when I get back to NIH, but what I think is going on is that there's some segment of the population that's susceptible to food supply. So if you just give them more food, they'll just absorb it. Some part of the population is not, and some part is in between. And what's happening is that we're just increasing food supply. We're pushing, we call it the push effect. We're pushing food on the population. Some is accepting it, some is not. And as a result, there's some waste. Okay, so that's my explanation of the obesity epidemic. Now, lest you think that this is a result in a vacuum, what we did is we actually took the EPA solid waste and we did it per capita. Surprisingly, they never expressed it this way. And we found that the EPA waste, solid waste that's going into dumps is actually mirroring, that we are actually progressively being more wasteful as a society as time goes on. Okay, so in the last remaining 5 minutes, I want to quickly say, what are some rules of thumb? So is there any? Can we do anything about this? The short answer, I think, is no. But that also doesn't go well in political circles and things like that. So one of the things we can do is we can simplify the model again. Remember that this is how your curve, right? So this is how you're changing. So if you're up here, if you're in this linear curve, and most people are, this is only for really, really lean people, then it's roughly linear. So that lean is a linear function of fat, and so then I can, and fat is just the mass divided by the lean, so then I can just turn this into a one-dimensional equation. And this is just the leaky integrator. So I was trying to come up with a good analogy for a leaky integrator. At first I had a leaking bucket, and then I realized that Torricelli's law is not the leaky integrator, right? It's square root. Otherwise, a bucket would never empty, right? It would bucket empties in finite time, but a capacitor doesn't. So it's a capacitor. It's called a leaky integrator. So basically, how much you burn is directly proportional to how much you weigh, and then you have some intake. So the nice thing about this is now we can solve for steady state, and we can get a rule of thumb. And the rule of thumb is that for every 23 kilocalories per day extra you eat is 1 kilogram on average. Okay, on average. That's a remarkably small amount. I was very shocked by this thing. You know, when we came up with the number, I redid it maybe 50 times to see if it was true, because I thought it couldn't possibly be this small. But, you know, and it's actually the number that was around in the 60s. They actually believed this. I was listening to the Enright files in the car on the way down, and they were playing this show from the 1952, and the guy was quoted this number, essentially. So that's your rule of thumb. So the time constant, then, is 1 year based on that, right? So this is why diets don't work. It takes you 1 year before you really know what your response is. And so most people give up diets after, say, a couple of weeks or months. And so by the time the delay is so long, the feedback is so slow, you really have no idea what you're doing. And so nobody really knows, you know, if you really want to lose weight, you have to change how much you eat and keep that fixed for the rest of your life. And you know, I don't have time to discuss why that's impossible, but it seems to be. So this is what people have called the paradox of eating, is that, okay, so if you want to maintain 5 pounds, right, then you have to maintain intake to 50 kilocalories per day. American cookies are pretty big, so 150 kilocalories, maybe Canadian is 120 calories, I don't know. I changed the calories now because now we're really talking nutrition and I think that food labels in Canada still report kilocalories rather than, they actually call them calories with a big C. That's really a kilocalorie. You know, they should just report kilojoules, but they don't. So is this a paradox, right? You exercise, you burn out 300 calories one day, you have a beer, you get an extra 150 calories a day, you have sushi at the tea, you eat an extra, 10 calories a day. How is it that we can maintain weight if the fluctuations are so big? And the answer is that there's a long time constant. It's 1 year. It's the average of what you eat over the year. That's what matters, okay? So if we look at the example energy intake, so what they did is they actually tried to measure what people ate. This is extremely difficult because it's notorious that food records are inaccurate. This was a study done with nutritionists at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Beltsville, Maryland, and they took 29 people for 1 year, recorded what they ate every day. Okay, so we can't really believe it, but I think we can believe the fluctuations. You see that the fluctuations are huge, right? One day this person ate 5,500 calories. You know, one day they ate 700 calories. And this is not Thanksgiving or Christmas. This is just some random day in the summer. They decided to have an all-you-can-eat ribs eating contest. And the coefficient of variation is roughly, was constant, around 20 to 30%, and yet the coefficient of variation for the weight is 1%, right? But you can see this exactly by just doing a little bit of analysis. So we assume that the intake is some noise-driven stochastic process. Let's assume white noise. I'll talk about correlated noise later. This is called an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process, right? Because it's a linear leaky integrator driven by noise. And the question we want to know is, given the coefficient of variation of the intake, what is the coefficient of variation in the mass? Is it consistent? So you can calculate in stochastic systems, you can solve one problem exactly. That's the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. So fortunately, we chose that one as the model for body weight. So if you stick in the numbers, you find that the coefficient a variation, right, which is the standard deviation in the mass divided by the mean of the mass, is reduced by a factor of 15 to 20 compared to the coefficient of variation of the intake. So there is no paradox whatsoever that if you have 23% variation, you're going to have less than 2% variation. And that's why if you're maintaining body weight, you can go ahead and have that steak dinner. There's a one-year time constant. After 1 year, it'll be forgotten. You can starve yourself one day. You can exercise a lot one day. You can do whatever. As long as you don't correlate your activities, you're fine. Right, so here's a simulation for 10 years. Here's what happens if you correlate. Okay, I just increased the correlation a little bit. Now you start to wander. And so what we did, what I did with my ex-string theorist colleague, Vipul Periwal, was that we looked at for all the people, and we found that there was a correlation of the correlation, so that the more correlated their food intake was, so that if they ate a lot one day, they ate a lot the next day, they ate a lot the next day. If they ate a little bit one day, they ate a little bit. The higher their BMI, the body mass index, right? So what I think is going on is that there is a ratchet in your brain that if you go above, that you are defending your weight. Okay, so I have not talked about this at all, so this is all speculation. But I have a model for it, but I haven't presented it. If you are eating some amount, you seem to defend that weight. We know that in short-term gain, there's the Robert De Niro effect, right? He can become 40 pounds extra, be Jack LaMotta, and then the next movie he plays a priest where he's like scrawny, right? Within 1 year, he can go from 250 pounds to 160 pounds. So we know that you can easily, if you just have short-term weight gains and changes, you can adapt, but long-term weight changes, almost all dieters regain their weight. Okay, this is just a fact. And I think what's going on is that if you are correlated in your life, then occasionally you will stay high, and then there's a ratchet in your brain that resets, and now you want to defend that weight. And it's a one-way ticket, so it's like entropy, right? The settings get undone, and you just keep on going higher and higher. So the way to not gain weight, so I think the moral of the story is you can't lose weight, you can just not gain weight. Okay, that could be the... the second law of eating dynamics. The third law will be you can't stay the same. So thank you very much. I just want to say, so Kevin Hall is my colleague who taught me everything I know about metabolism. He actually does this for a living, for real. I'm kind of a mathematician that moonlights in various areas. Vipul Periwal truly is a string theorist at Princeton. I recruited him to come to MIT because he wanted to do, not MIT, to NIH, because he wanted to do biology. And every once in a while, I go into his office to try to convince him that topological quantum field theory is relevant to diabetes, but he kicks me out of his office every time. But one day, I think it will be true. Thank you.